things that to beware, because when they spoke on certain times of the day, because Yorkshire pudding weighed heavily on the soul. And I'm sure that that may well apply here tonight. Could I say that if you feel to look at church statistics after dinner is not perhaps the best fare, you've got Colin Sinclair to blame. It was he who suggested at our census task force that I write to Mr. Still and suggest that a presentation be made. It was. And Mr. Still kindly agreed, and Sandy got in touch with me, and we battled a little bit. No, we didn't battle. We discussed the title, and we settled on Life After Decline. Sandy thought that was a great title. I suspected at the time, because he'd be retiring sometime soon.
I just thought it was brilliant.
Oh, thank you, Sandy. Well, I... That's turning the other cheek. The census, as all of you probably know, at least those of you from Scotland, was held in November 1994 and was published in September of this year. Perhaps I should apologise that for those of you who come from Ireland and from other parts, that we'll perhaps be talking a little bit domestically. But on the other hand, Scotland, in terms of church going, is placed somewhat between England at the lower end and Northern Ireland at the higher end. So I think there are some lessons which can be gleaned for England and for Scotland from the exercise that we've gone through here. The 81% of the churches participated in the census, which is 6% more than in 1984 in the previous census. And this was a very encouraging response, which gives a high degree of accuracy, we believe, to the results. These two censuses held in 1984 and 1994 were the first church censuses overall that were held since John Hiatt conducted censuses in the late 1950s and published a book which caused a lot of discussion at the time. The Catholics and the Methodists have conducted their own censuses annually. I'm not sure for how long, but they have done it for a number of years. But as far as I know, other denominations do not do that. The book, Prospects for Scotland 2000, which contains a full analysis of the census results and some commentary on it, is available at a special price of a reduction from $14.99 to $10.99. Now, Frank Gibson, who is an accountant and who's in charge of sales, tells me that he deals in round numbers. So it's a reduction for £15 to £11. But he and Mike Frew, who are both members of our Bible Society board and to whom I am accountable, and they will be accountable to me for the money, of course, will be happy to wait upon you. You can pay by check or by cash or by credit card. I have 24 copies, and I hope I don't need to carry any away with me. But I would encourage you to take this and to use it prayerfully and strategically as you consider the work of your congregation. Here we have a breakdown, not only denominationally, but also geographically. And I think that is particularly helpful. In addition, on the seats you will have found the special issue of Quadrant magazine, which those of you who are ministers in Scotland ought to have received in September. To remind you of the summary of the results of the census, I thought that would be helpful for you to have it again. And also some leaflets about the census conferences, seminars, which will be held, God willing, at the end of March. I hope that some of you may come to these, and we look at much more in depth than we'll be able to do tonight. Well, the subject is, as was suggested, life beyond or life after decline. Now, what basically are the results of the census? One has to read the book to get all the results, but what are the summary results? First of all, the good news. One church in Scotland in six grew in its attendance over the first 4 years of this decade by 20% or more. I think that is encouraging, that one church in six grew. Now, many of these are, in fact, what were described as first-generation churches this afternoon, are independent churches or charismatic churches, and there are particular reasons why they grow more quickly, if only because they start from a smaller base. But nevertheless, I think that it is significant, and those of us who come from other traditions should ask what can we learn from them. The second aspect of good news is the encouraging number of children who are still attending Sunday school or Bible class in Scotland. The proportion of children under 15 in church in Scotland is higher than their proportion in the civil population. That is in relating the church population to the civil population. That, I believe, is very encouraging. We still have the children in Scotland to a greater extent than the churches do in England, almost certainly less than they do in Northern Ireland, but nevertheless, significantly, they are with us. Then the third piece of good news is that there is a midweek Bible study in almost six churches out of 10, 58%. This is a slight reduction of 59% in 1984, but the margin of error there is would suggest that that has been static. It's interesting that Protestant churches, in fact, have increased. Catholic churches have declined in midweek Bible studies from 45% to 34%, which is quite significant. Probably reflects the decline of the charismatic movement within the Catholic Church, which has occurred in that decade. However, in the Protestant churches, we've seen an increase of 1%, and the proportion of the church members who attend is higher. It's 13% compared with 11% a year before. So I believe that that is encouraging news, that in the face of quite significant decline, the midweek Bible studies have in fact grown. Now that must, I believe, be good news for us, for those of us who have a spiritual understanding of the church. However, the census contains not only good news, unfortunately, it also contains bad news. And the bad news, first of all, is that attendance fell from 1 in 6 of the adult population to 1 in 7 of the adult population between 1984 and 1994. And if we put this into a longer perspective, if we go back to John Hyatt's census in 1959, we discover that, in fact, there's been a 50% drop over 35 years. So we are, in fact, facing a very significant decline, a 50% drop over 35 years. And Robin Gill, in his various books, which I'll refer to in a moment, reckons that in the UK generally, today, 1/6 of the people of the Victorian church attenders, word that differently, 1/6 of the number of people who attended church in the Victorian period when the church going was at its height attend church today. So church going has declined by 5/6 over that period in spite of a higher population, civil population today. So we are in fact facing a very significant decline in church going in this country. One congregation at least disappears every week. There's on average over the past decade 225 people less in church every Sunday. Now the average church attendance in Scotland is about 223. Now we have a high average mainly because the Catholic parishes draw from a much larger area than Protestant parishes do, and they have large attendances. That's one of the significant differences between the church-going patterns of Catholics and of Protestants. So that's true in England as well as in Scotland, that they have invested much less in church plant than we have done, and they multiply services. So the average church attendance is 222, 223, but we are losing 225 people each week. Now, I say that is one congregation, and I say at least because many of our churches have much less than 250 people in church on a Sunday. In fact, the census revealed that over 40% of the churches in Scotland have less than 50 people or less attending church. And that does raise a lot of questions about the spiritual resources in terms of leadership for these churches. As Peter Brawley in his commentaries asks the question, is Scotland becoming a nation of small churches? Then going on to the fourth point here, one third of the children and one half of the teenagers leave the church within 10 years. Now that is a very serious hemorrhage. I mean, we are blessed in Scotland in that we do have a relatively high proportion of children in church, but we don't keep them. And within 10 years, one third of the children and one half of the teenagers have dropped out. People say that in business the secret is to get people in the door. Well, we've got the children in the door, but we're not keeping them. And perhaps we need to develop strategies how to hold our children more. There are also in the census some fascinating facts. The strongest areas of church attendance are the Western Isles, where 39% of the population attend church, which is slightly less than in the United States of America. Mullaghbal and Monklands come next with 25%. The weakest areas are, I regret to say, Lothian with 10% and Aberdeen with 9%. Aberdeen was at the bottom of the league in 84, and I regret remains there. I remember in 1985 when the 84 census was published, it was published at the same week as Aberdeen won the UEFA Cup. And I remember Norrie McIver telling me that he preached that week on Aberdeen being top of one league and bottom of the other. Why? I now want to go on to try to analyse this, and there's a certain degree of analysis in here, but what I've said and what Peter Brawley have said in here is really something different from what I want to say tonight. Why is it that we are facing such decline and will continue to face it? I remember about 10 years ago coming up in the train from London meeting George Eliot, who at that time worked, it was at the ministry department, Frank? Stewardship department. And we had a long chat, courtesy of British Rail. And he was saying, in the Church of Scotland, we are approaching a precipice. The age profile of the church is such that, in fact, unless we are able to renew the church, then we face a problem. That's true not only of the Church of Scotland, it's true of many, I would say the majority of churches in Scotland today. Why is it that people are abandoning the church? Now, I believe it is important for us to ask this question if we want to help arrest and reverse the decline. We want to try to identify what the reasons are. Now, the popular response is that the reason is secularization, that society is becoming secularized. Jim Packer has given a popular definition of secularization as practicing the absence of God. And increasingly, people are practicing the absence of God. And largely following Peter Berger, many people have seen a church decline in terms of a result of the advancing secularization. This is essentially the position that is taken by Os Guinness and by Leslie Newbegin, and they argue indeed for an alternative world view. However, this analysis has been recently challenged by a number of people, and Robin Gill in his books has perhaps articulated this more popularly than most people. Now, I'm grateful to David Wright because he asked me to write a longer review article. I'm not sure how long it is, but he gave me four books on Robin Gill, and this came at the same time as the census was, this request came at the same time as the census was being published and the same time as just after I'd written to Mr. Still. And I said, well, perhaps I could combine the two. I'm not going to give you the review because I have still to write that. But I am grateful for putting me on to Robin Gill. He, those of you may not know much about Robin Gill. I know very little. He taught in New College for 12 years, David? Yes. Was a cleric of the Scottish Episcopal Church somewhere near Coldstream, and then he has now gone to the University of Kent, I think. The first book I heard about was Beyond Decline, A Challenge to the Churches. And then he published The Myth of the Empty Church, and more recently, A Vision for Growth. This is an easy read, and it's a popular presentation. The most satisfying one of all I found to be this one, The Myth of the Empty Church, in which he deals with the results of research that has been done into church attendance over, really, since the middle of the last century. And he gathers that. It's just a pity he doesn't deal very much with Scotland. A lot of, in spite of the fact that he worked here for 12 years, a lot of the focus here is on Wales and on England, to some extent on Wales. But I'm grateful to David for having asked me to do this, because it has helped me to think through, and I'm still thinking through the analysis, because I had implicitly accepted what Peter Berger and Os Guinness and Leslie Newbegin have said, and I still accept their analysis. But I think what Robin Gill has done for me is he's raised questions. He says there are other reasons, and that secularization is not the primary reason, he would argue. It is a confirming reason, that there are other, what he calls, social reasons. But I'll come to these in a moment. First of all, what Gill says is that surveys have shown that people stop attending church not because of atheism, but because of apathy. Now, during Frank Gibson's imperial reign in the Social Responsibility Department, we did a survey of, what was it called, Frank? Scottish Church and Social Concern Survey, which was done jointly by the Social Responsibility Department and the Bible Society. And people were asked in that survey, those who stopped attending church, why do you no longer go to church? Only one in six said they no longer went to church because they no longer believed. They said they didn't go to church because they didn't have time. In other words, it was a question of priorities rather than of principles. And of course, there is a great deal of sympathy for the Christian faith. Over 60, 70, sometimes much higher percentage of people believe that Jesus is the Son of God in our society. And I was really quite discouraged by Steve Bruce's article in the Herald about Christmas. I don't know if any of you read it, in which he was arguing that really we should stop celebrating Christmas because it's no longer, you know, Christianity is no longer popular. And I felt that he was really going along this secularization analysis quite uncritically. And I was disappointed because I have appreciated, although he's not, I don't think he's a Christian, I have appreciated some of the analysis he's written before. It is true, of course, that secularization is a contributing to the decline. But what Robin Gill argues is that church decline predates the erosion of conventional Christian belief. He argues that the churches have been declining since the 1880s, at the latest, some of them before that. Secondly, he says that the United States, the existence of the strength of the church in the United States challenges this analysis. That in the United States, the churches have bucked the trend. And the United States is, in one sense, probably more secularized as a society than we are. That's my impression from fairly frequent visits over the last number of years. That certainly the polarization between Christians and extreme liberals is much greater there than it is here. And yet, in spite of that, 40% of the population continue to attend church regularly. That's three times the number that attend here in Scotland. I was visiting in the States in November and had the privilege of speaking in a Presbyterian church in a new suburb of the town of Jackson in Mississippi. It was a Presbyterian church, Highlands Presbyterian Church it was called. They had a baptismal service, and the minister asked the toddlers to come to the front. And out of a congregation of roughly 250 people, 60 children, aged between 4 and 7, I would say, came to the front. Now, I do not know any congregation in Scotland that could match these proportions. I think this is an illustration of how the churches in America are, in fact, being able to buck the trend. On my way back, I visited Charlotte and met Doug Kelly, and made renewed contact with him really after many years, and was fascinated to see the new campus that Reformed Seminary is in process of purchasing there from a Baptist church. And it's a magnificent campus. And why are the Baptist church selling it? Not because they're in decline, but because they're grown out of it. It's a huge church, and yet it's now too small. And the Reformed Seminary is in process of buying this magnificent facility, as the Americans would say. Thirdly, Gills argues that secularization is reversible. And he challenges the popular concept that, in fact, secularization will carry all before it, and modernity will destroy supernatural religion. As evidence of this, he brings not only what is happening in the United States, but also the resurgence of religious fundamentalism around the world. In Muslim fundamentalism, Hindu fundamentalism, Buddhist fundamentalism in Taiwan now. And I was fascinated at a conference I was at in Germany in the summer to hear some of the Russian Orthodox priests complain about their fundamentalists, the real hardliners who would not cooperate with anyone else, the real sort of, they were fundamentalists. And there's a kind of resurgence of fundamentalism, and it's turned the tide of history in a country like Iran, for example. So he is arguing, in fact, that secularization is not irreversible. And I remember a few years ago, and David Reitratz was there too, when David Bebbington gave a paper on this in the history of Britain, showing how that, in fact, in the last century, the evangelical revival reversed a great deal of secularizing tendencies in society. And he was saying, you know, that God can do the same again through us. Now, moving on, finally, to Gill's own analysis. He argues that, in fact, social reasons contribute very significantly to decline. I'm not yet clear from reading him whether, in fact, he's saying that social reasons are the main factors. But I think it's fair to him to say that they contribute very significantly to decline. Social reasons, social factors over which, by the grace of God, we can have some control. Let me just quote what he says here. He is arguing, basically, that empty churches foster decline. That's his thesis. Empty churches, even half-empty churches, foster decline. And the reasons that he gives for these are as follows. He goes back into the history of our over-provision of churches. Why is it that we are so over-provided with churches? And he does say that Scotland is much less over-provided than England, but we know the problems of union and readjustment, and these go on. He goes back to the extraordinary overbuilding that took place in the Victorian era. And he demonstrates that these churches were never full. Never full. He says there were more church seats in many parishes than there were people to put on them. And even if everybody went to church, they could not fill the church. But there was a competitive spirit among the churches, and they were in the age of empire, the age of progress, the age of expansionism. And, of course, what happened was that these churches started with massive debt. And the massive debt, once the churches began to decline, which began in the 1880s, the pressure was on for union, what we would call union and readjustment, although he does not use the term. He then makes the point that closures always involve a considerable loss of members. I measured the congregations of neighbouring chapels. This was in some part in England. And by chapels, you mean Methodist chapels, Baptist chapels. This was in a remote rural area to test out this last proposition, that is that closure of churches almost always involves a considerable loss of church members. The evidence, he said, was startling. In the decade before a chapel was closed, it tended to lose half of its congregation. When it actually closed, only half of the remaining members of the congregation transferred to neighboring chapels. And even in their new chapel, those who did transfer were considerably less active than they had been in their previous chapel. In short, only a remnant from a closing congregation tended to move to and remain active in a new congregation. Now we know that that has been repeated again and again in the history of union and readjustment. And then, of course, historically, you've got what he calls the clustering of churches, several churches coming under one minister. But again, he argues this contributes to decline. Once clergy, he argues, and he's got evidence for this, once clergy have charge of more than two congregations, they tend to lose contact and members. And several very convincing surveys have shown this to be the case. Of course, there are exceptions. Individual priests or ministers who cope with clusters of churches while retaining high levels of church going. Yet in general, the evidence points firmly to in the opposite direction. Looking after more than two congregations is generally a recipe for a decline in church going. Now, what he is saying, indeed, is that the policy which the churches have followed and executed and continue to follow and execute is contributing to the process of decline. He argues more speculatively that empty churches are off-putting to the outsiders and even to fringe church people. And perhaps more convincingly, he argues that empty churches send negative signals to the whole of society about the well-being of the church and the well-being of the Christian faith. And he would argue that more than anything else, the empty churches of the country have contributed to the popular conception of the church as declining. The social factors are important for Gill also in the growth of the church. And it's very encouraging, although Gill is not an evangelical, it's very encouraging to see an academic, you know, arguing that the church can grow and arguing for church growth. And he argues that in fact, if we take these social factors seriously, then we can help, by the grace of God, the churches to recover. He makes a point, and I just mentioned it in passing, that which is a sociological factor, that he reckons that the evidence suggests that when people come to faith, that belonging comes before believing. And he says that most evangelicals put believing first. Now, I just mentioned that in passing. Belonging, he says, comes before believing. And that these, in other words, social factors are involved in our coming to faith. Perhaps just by way of conclusion, I could say that full churches often have a supportive social infrastructure. And I think this is particularly true in the United States. I was tremendously impressed in this last visit that I made in November. I was in Jackson, then I went to Orlando, then I went to Charlotte. And I spoke in quite a number of churches, some of them big churches, and all of them, with one exception, were churches which had were churches which were virtually full. And as I flew out of Charlotte, I wrote down I just asked, what are the factors in the church in America that we don't have? And I came up with four. One is that most churches have an educational policy. Not just Sunday school, but day school. And their people are protected from the influence of humanism in our public educational system in this country. And I believe that that must be a significant factor in the way that churches have been able there to buck the trend. Secondly, many churches and even seminaries have developed extensive counseling ministries. Now, I know that some people go over the top in counseling, but Christians do get mixed up and they do need to be counseled. Now, what happens in this country? They go to the social work department, which is perhaps the most atheistic, the most humanistic department in society. And a social worker very often undermines all that we do in the church. Now, in America, many of the churches have their own social work department, if you like. They have a counseling. Jackson, Reformed Seminary in Jackson, has a marriage counseling service, which they house in the old house where the seminary began 25, 30, 40 years ago. Thirdly, most of the churches in America develop interest groups.
Whatever your interest is, you will find other people in the church who share it. And so a sense of community is developed in and around the church. And the fourth thing that impressed me was the high premium that churches in America put on missiology. I mean, the seminaries I visited in America, and I've been to several in the last few years, missiology is far higher up the agenda than it is in the seminaries and the theological colleges and Bible colleges of this country. Far higher. And the expectation is that the churches will grow. Now, we are living in a society and in a church where the expectation is that the churches will decline. And as Jock Stein or Peter Nielsen has said, we have come to terms with the tidy management of decline. Now, that mentality is impossible, or at least almost impossible, in the American church, where there is such a much stronger focus on missiology. And as I reflected on these reasons, I couldn't help thinking that some of the more charismatic churches, which are growing in this country, do tend to have schools, they have counseling, they have some of these factors. And I wonder whether some of these social infrastructure, which is helping the church in America, ought not to be things that we might be at least considering here in this country. And I just want to close by asking, are we sufficiently aware of the importance of social factors and social reasons of why people both go to church and why they don't go to church? I think that we're so afraid very often of nominality that we suspect every reason that is not strictly spiritual. But in fact, people, all of us, are much more than spiritual beings. And provided these social factors are in perspective and in proportion, not all of them are unworthy. And I sometimes wonder whether we today, as we face secularization, may not be like the Church of Scotland in 1793, was it, David, when they debated whether there should be foreign missions, maybe 1796. And there were many good men who argued that if God was going to save the heathen, he would do it independently through another Pentecost. In other words, he would do it repeating the day of Pentecost. Whereas William Carey and the evangelicals argued that in fact God used ordinary means. He didn't use supernatural means, he used ordinary means. And I wonder whether some of these social factors are ordinary means which we ought not to be considering and asking God to guide us in. Now, having said all of that, if you buy the book and if you've read the book or if you read the book, you will see that I argue in a different angle. I argue, you know, much more for a spiritual understanding of the church in my contribution to this book. And I would not want to anything that I've said tonight to take away from the importance of the ministry of word and spirit, without which the social factors will come to nothing. The ministry of word and spirit, which we see punctuating the growth of the church in the book of Acts in six summary statements, it's either the word or the spirit or both. And it's so important that we focus on the ministry of the word and we pray down the ministry of the Spirit in the church, so that people who come into our churches will be conscious that God is among us, as Paul said, and that there be that sense of transcendence in our services, and that there be that sense of God in our midst. And one of the encouraging things that I noted through discussing with some of the staff in the seminaries in America is that there's a growing awareness there that the mission of the church grows out of the worship of the church. And missiology and worship are being much more closely related in the thinking of the churches in America. Well, I've gone 5 minutes over the half hour, and I apologize for that, but if there are questions or contributions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. Yes, it was that missiology has a higher premium. Well, the fact is that, okay, the church is not the church unless it's reaching out. The church, unless the church is fulfilling mission, it is no longer, it is not the church. Yeah, okay. Yes. Yes. Missio, thank you. Yes, and I'm not thinking only of foreign missions. Yes.
Highlighted his concerns that secularization is not natural. And interestingly enough, one of the gurus of secular thought, Harvey Cox, with secular city, recanted his views in 1984, which I think was God in the secular city. And the three instances he gave of the pushing back of secularism were Poland, the moral majority, and the base communities in Latin America, with the interplay of politics and concern the open route for the open mind. I think Cox, and I know at the time when Cox's recantation over came out, that Robin Gill was very interested in it, and obviously he developed that.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Robin Gill, in one of the books I've read, does mention Poland and the moral majority. I skipped these because Poland is rapidly changing recently. And I'm not sure how strong the moral majority. I felt I'd covered the States. But the base communities in South America are a helpful example of that.
What you said in Maine is very, very challenging to many of us here, certainly to me. Now, Terry Johnson, who's here, where are you, man? Hey. Now, he would say the very opposite. His experience has been that he had learned from a simplicity of congregational structure with us what has produced a fruitful church for him in Savannah. Would you like to speak a little of that? Terry, come on.
No.
Well, you do it whether you like it or not.
Well, I think that...
yes, you do.
I have found that there's a lot of energy in America, and that's a very positive thing. A lot of it, perhaps, is not well spent. But that there are certain commonalities, such as the consistent, faithful exposition of the scriptures. For example, the churches that you mentioned, every one of them are very committed to expository preaching. I think if I know for sure which ones you have, they also have significant worship services. There's a commitment to prayer. So that I think that it's the simple historically proven elements that continue today to be the basis for a growing, thriving, prospering church. And I find myself, in a growing situation, constantly returning to the ancient paths, and encouraging people to keep the Lord's Day and therefore be under the means of grace twice on Sunday. But we believe the means of grace are the means through which people grow. Well, if they're in worship Sunday morning, Sunday night, they're under the preaching of the Word. They're receiving the sacraments. They are participating in the prayers where two or more are gathered in His name. They are enjoying the fellowship of the saints. Lord's Day observance has been important. I find myself more and more talking about family worship at home during the week. and undergirding the whole with prayer. Also, there's been a renewed emphasis on the singing of the Psalter, which you all are all accustomed to here, but virtually disappearing in American Presbyterianism. And that too contributing to a deepening of the piety and commitment of the people. America is, I think, very difficult to analyze. Not that I disagree with anything that you're saying. There's tremendous energy. Entrepreneurial spirit is in the churches. The kind of free market approach, I think, has been to our advantage in that we are all grabbing for shares of the market, as it were, and we're competing with each other. But I still believe that at the heart of the healthy, growing church are very simple, basic elements that have worked in every society, in every place, in every time, whether Scotland, England, or North America: the preaching of the word, prayer, the fellowship of the saints, the worship as being the vital thing that upon the church grow.
Do you have interest groups?
Yes. We have an age-divided Sunday school where people are getting together on the basis of common interests, and that includes the adults, right on through to the elderly. So once a week we are splitting by age group for an hour with open Bibles to interact in areas of common interest. And then the two worship services, of course, in the whole
group.
Beyond that, not a great deal. No, not a great deal. Not for us.
You haven't got four walking groups.
But he's right. Most of them do. Divorcees are getting together.
Well, that's what I want.
Single parents. We don't have any of that ourselves. But he's right that that is definitely the trend. Mm-hmm. Is to try to find some basis of appeal to get people through the door. Get them tied in socially to the church, and maybe in that context then they'll hear the gospel be converted.
Yep.
Jim?
This is a very valid and, I think, significant analysis of all the people.
Speak up, Jim. Speak up.
You mentioned Gil, I think, saying that the social reasons predated the secularization movement.
Well, he argues that the decline in church going predated the secularization.
Now, I'm interested in the date of 1880 that you mentioned, because that was approximately when the Sunday school was invented.
Yes.
And I did some research into this some time ago. It was very interesting to discover that there were voices warning the church that the institution of Sunday schools would lead to the loss of children in the course of time. And certainly this has happened. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm equipped or qualified to comment on it, except there is a table in the back of this book somewhere of Sunday school attendances. And in fact, Sunday school attendances continued high much longer than church attendances. And the decline in Sunday schools has been relatively recent. Whether Sunday schools are a good thing or an effective ministry in the long term, I'm not sure. I mean, I can't answer that question, I'm afraid. I'm not ducking it. I just don't know enough about it. With reference to what was said about the states, I would concur with what was said, but the strength of the social factors in the states is so much that even when there's not that preaching of the word, that the church, most, unless they're very liberal, there's a lot of wishy-washy churches that are overflowing. In my experience too. So that, I mean, I think the social factors are enormously strong in the American church. That's my observation. Now, I'm not sold on everything that happens in America, in the church there. I appreciate and value enormously my visits to America, but I'm not suggesting for one moment that we import the American model. I think we have to ask, what lessons can we learn? And I think that the social factors, the social infrastructures which surround the American churches are a very significant factor in the fact that America, uniquely in the Christian world, has been able to back the secularization trend.
Well, I think that's very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, point just from what Jim was saying about Sunday schools. Is it not true that initially Sunday schools began through a great evangelistic desire, but that Sunday schools have become institutionalized? They have taken the place of meaningful family worship. Parents have handed over to Sunday school teachers responsibility of spiritual production and care of their children. That it has led to a long-term decline because the initial impetus and evangelistic concern behind the establishing of Sunday schools has really fallen away by and large, except of course. And one of the great needs that we have today is the recovery in our congregations of meaningful family worship. I'm astonished, see, in my own congregation where I have known some encouragement, to see how little family worship has taken root in the lives of the people. How little we encourage it, how little we go about helping parents and families to find their way forward to begin it. I would reckon that that's an area that we greatly need to grapple with if we're thinking of the long-term spiritual good of our children and keeping them within the fellowship of the saints. Mm-hmm. That from the very beginning, they discover in the home those realities that we trust that we increasingly discover in the church fellowship.
I'd absolutely agree with that. I think we have to work at it. But I think that the traditional format of family worship, really, we've got to experiment with that because, I mean, John Sharp is not here, I don't think, but I remember him telling me that in his parish, in East Kilbride, very few homes have a table that they eat at. They never are together at any one point in the day. And, you know, we have to encourage them in that kind of very different context from the cottage Saturday night.
Consider that the influence of the schools on the children come a very close second in atheism to that of the social work department.
Yes.
You cannot ignore that.
Yes.
I said an interesting book a wee while ago by another Robin, if I remember rightly, Robin Gamble, on the irrelevant church, in which he argued that the part of the reasons for our decline today stem from our ignoring of the less well-off in our country. That the churches have tended to attract, to build on those who are better off, the middle classes and upwards, and that he traces this decline from Victorian times, following on from the great revivals of the church among the poor people in previous ages, for instance in Methodism, the Wesleyan revivals and so on, which where the church reached out to those who were poor and needy, and now has gone back. And I wonder if that's another social reason that we should be looking at. How much do we care for and nurture and bring the gospel to the poor in our society?
Yes, well, I've heard, remember, Tom Houston at the Manila Congress in 1989 arguing very strongly that we cannot solve the challenge of secularization without also caring for the poor. He felt the two, one was the alter ego of the other. The problem, of course, is that once we do care for the poor and the poor respond to the gospel, they become upwardly mobile. And you see, we have to keep on reaching out. Yes?
First and foremost, thank you for that very valuable survey. But I'm wondering, it seems to me there are two tremendously important factors that haven't been mentioned. And one is television. And the other is the motor car, which takes whole families away Sunday after Sunday into the country.
Yeah.
You comment on the possible effect of those tremendous
Yes. I think the motor car has worked both ways, in that it has brought people to church and has made the clustering of churches, whether desirable or not, possible. I think television is not only a counter attraction, but it is also affecting the way people think and the way people absorb information. And I mean, that is really, I think, more at the root of the problem of television, simply that it's something that steals people away from church. Some work has been done by a man called Neil Postman in America and somebody called Guy Playfair, I think, in this country, and looking at the effect of constant television viewing. And they argue that, in fact, television is robbing people of rationality. And our response to the gospel is not primarily intellectual or rational, that's true, but the gospel comes to us through the mind, and we have to count the cost. And basically what these people argue is that television is robbing people of the capacity to respond, to make a rational response to a reasonable offer. And perhaps we should really look a lot more at that, and how is this affecting the way people understand us? Yes?
This is not to argue with anything you've said.
Well, feel free to argue if you wish.
I'm not arguing. I think it's important. As I sit here, having read people like David Wells recently and John MacArthur, and then listened to yourself, we're dealing here with godly men who are committed to similar principles. And yet they seem to be coming to the whole issue from completely different angles, and indeed arguing against one another almost. And I was interested this afternoon, and Mr. Chapman was speaking. So as soon as you mentioned the word strategy in mission, then, you know, immediately you hear David Wells say, let's get away from strategies, that's what's wrong with the evangelical church. And it seems to me today, we seem to have got into, and I remember you speaking some years ago about the charismatic evangelical kind of divide. And I think, you know, what I'm confused about is, where is the right road ahead when you have godly men on both sides saying that we need strategies, and you have people like David Wells and John MacArthur saying that these strategies, especially in America, are ultimately flawed? Now, we're either into strategies or we're not into strategies, or what strategies aren't we into?
Well, I think that everybody is into a strategy of some kind, whether they're aware of it or not. Yeah. I think it's a question of both. It's not a question of either or. It's a question of both and, surely. And it is true that you can carry the strategy model too far. And what I say in my contribution to the book here is that the marketing model of the church is carried in all the churches in Scotland, not just in the Church of Scotland, carried far too far. And we need to get back to biblical models of the church, because I hope I'm not offending anyone when I speak about a Thatcherized theology. The church has been, you know, that finance has come to mean everything in the way that the church thinks. And that is applying the market, the criteria of the marketplace. And that's obviously going too far. On the other hand, money is important. We can't ignore it. And it is a factor. We can't shore up non-viable congregations, you know, in large numbers forever. We can't do that. So I think that it's a question of getting a balance, basically. Now, I know David Wells, and I deeply appreciate him, and know him through the Lausanne Committee, and he's made an enormous contribution. But, one of the things that I think David Wells and Os Guinness and these people perhaps lack is the practical side. You know, they are looking at it from a theoretical, academic point of view, and it's right that they do. But I think when an academic says, my view is the only view, then there's a problem, because the practitioner, you know, does work from a different angle, and we have to listen to the practitioner as well as to the theoretician. Now, it's very important that we do have people like David Wells and Os Guinness, and I deeply appreciate all that they have done. And I listen to them with great profit on every occasion I've heard them. But there is another side. You know, there's the side of the practitioner. How do you present the gospel to someone to someone really at street level. And I think that it's a different gift in some ways. So it's a balance, surely.
Comment. I'm sure we're all here, we're hopefully biblical and expository preachers of God's word, and at our Sunday schools we try and run down the line of being evangelical with our young folk. And what you said, the statistics are quite intriguing, but this is a comment, really it's a comment or a question which came to me while we were discussing this at a recent fraternal, which I brought from my own congregation, is that we talk about statistics, about bucking the trend, but as a nation, if we see God as sovereign, and this really came to me after hearing John Brand of the African Inland Mission, where he preached in my church and said that in Kenya, that one congregation, one new church was being established every 2 days. Mm-hmm, and a small congregation is 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
With illiterate teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And we can theorize, we can look at the social reasons, we can blame their cars or the TVs or whatever. But I think we've let God out of it. And somehow we almost, by divine right, expect God to bless us as a church, as a nation. I just wondered whether we are right in expecting that. And I believe that the trend can be bucked by God's people doing mission, God's people being the witnesses, God's people being the evangelists. But I think to try and formulate a strategy, I can't really see how that's going to work. Because forming a strategy almost, you say to God, well, God, you are going to work irrespective. It's just under the sovereignty of God as a nation, as a church. Are we expecting too much? Or do we have to go down even further for something to rise out of the ashes? That is, I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but I'd like your response to it.
Well, I think that strategies, I believe in strategy. And I believe in strategizing, but the strategies must be baptized into Christ. That's crucial, it seems to me. And I think that well, Paul had a strategy, and our Lord had a strategy, and that there's biblical precedent for this. It is true that we can strategize and leave God out, just as we can preach and leave God out, although we might be quite orthodox in what we say. That's a question of attitude. I think that we need to bring God in and ask God to permeate our thinking as we strategize and to enable us in the power of His Spirit to execute the strategies. I say a little bit here about how some people have questioned goal setting from a Christian point of view, and they say, you know, it is wrong to set a goal for a church to grow. Now, I would argue that goal setting in itself is not wrong, because we all set goals. We decide how many pastoral visits we're going to make in a week. The question is, whether we're making the goal as an affirmation of faith in dependence upon God, or whether we're doing it in our own strength and saying we're going to bring in the kingdom of God. So, I mean, I'm agreeing with you in the spirit of what you say, but I'm a little bit nervous about throwing strategies out the window. I think it's time.
Don't you go away, Danny. I'm going to see the tea ready.
You better. I was going to ask him to close in prayer. You do it. Thank you.
Thank you.